WCCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report on Capitol Hill this hour.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
President Trump addresses a joint session of Congress saying the American dream is unstoppable and takes credit for what he says has been swift and unrelenting action on immigration, economy, and security.
I return to this chamber tonight to report that America's momentum is back, our spirit is back, our pride is back, our confidence is back. And the American dream is surging bigger and better than ever before.
It got rowdy with Congressman Al Green, a Democrat from Texas, booing and refusing to take a seat. The House Speaker chiming in.
Provided that members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum, the chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
And Congressman Green was escorted out. CBS News Special Report, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
I'm Brittany Merlot with WXCO News, your news roundup in a quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WXCO website at BullFallsRadio.com.
A setback for the Brewers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Brewers starting left-handed pitcher Aaron Ashby had to leave last night's spring training game in Arizona in the second inning. Manager Pat Murphy says it's an oblique muscle injury requiring an MRI. The Brewers went on to lose to the Reds 5-4. Ashby, the sixth Brewers pitcher, now dealing with an injury. NBA, the Bucks in Atlanta tonight to take on the Hawks. Milwaukee has won six of their last seven games, and they've now moved up to fourth place in the NBA's Eastern Conference. The Badgers men team getting ready to play Minnesota in the Twin Cities. Head coach Greg Gard.
Yeah, it is a border state. You know, we've recruited that area really well. That area has been really good to us. We've got really good players from there. It's important in terms of Big Ten tournament seeding. It's important to get the double bye if you can. And quite frankly, you boil it down to it's your next game and you're competitive and you want to win. The other stuff that could happen from that is a byproduct of, you know, doing good things on Wednesday night.
That's Wisconsin head coach Greg Gard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Matt Nair on air.
A lot of federal employees got this fork in the road letter. You can stay, but you're not really guaranteed anything. Luann's husband is a Vietnam veteran.
I wrote a letter to President Musk. My husband put his life on the line for our country.
Wow.
You are putting my husband's life on the line right now by cutting all those programs that are keeping him alive at the VA. Please call your legislators and tell them to stand up. This is not what America is.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, home of the Chad Holmes Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about, lots of feedback on the Zelensky thing, lots of feedback on the crybaby Trump and J.D. Vance thing. Lots of folks agreeing with me. It was an ambush. It was a setup. It was disgraceful. It was a black eye in the history of the country. A lot of that. And rightfully so. And I'm not going to go through all of the folks who, because we got a ton of positive response of going, look, this isn't who we are. Rick, it's going to be okay. I got people consoling me. It's going to be okay. This isn't who we are. And I hope that's true. I hope we as a country, this is one of those moments that wake us up and go, hey, this isn't who we are. We're better than this. We do believe that America is that shining city on the hill. We do believe that this is the place where people come for better lives and have high ideals and the right values. We do. But sadly, there were a good number of folks who didn't agree with me. A number of folks who, I'm not sure if it's for trolling purposes or if they actually believe the nonsense that came out of their fingers. But Jerry wrote, NATO is outdated and needs to be thrown onto the trash heap of history. There needs to be a new realigning of alliances with nations that share our values or are moving towards doing so. Europe, he says, is heading in the wrong direction. Now, again, a lot of coded possibilities. Jerry didn't respond to my follow-up of asking him to, you know, to actually clarify any of this, because I'm not sure what kind of realignment he's looking for and what those shared values are. I don't see a lot of shared values with Vladimir Putin. Sorry. Now, you could go, you know, Tucker Carlson did go to Russia, and look, there's a lot of white people around and they've got grocery stores. Is that what they mean? And is it, you know, that kind of homogeny that I hear from the right that they want? Is that the value that you're talking about? I sure hope not, but I disagree on every point. Brian writes, outdated organizations like NATO and the UN need to be abandoned and reimagined. Rick, it's not 1945. Russia is not the USSR. We could forge a new path, he says. We could forge a new path with Russia and China as allies instead of continuing to live in your Cold War childhood fog. I actually thought that was pretty good. Now, look, maybe he's right. Maybe I am living in this childhood Cold War fog. Maybe I am. But I also don't believe Russia and China have our best interest in heart. I believe China is hell-bent on world domination and being the superpower for the next 100 years or forever. I think Russia wants to get the old band back together. So I'm distrustful of both. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is my Cold War childhood fog. But I gotta tell you, what they tell us is kind of frightening. So I'm not buying that, Brian, but thanks for the email. Rick writes, the real truth that you will not acknowledge is that the U.S. caused this war in Ukraine by pushing for NATO expansion to the east. Rick writes, what would we do if China, Russia, and Cuba had an organization committed to our destruction and wanted to expand into Mexico? Well, your premise, NATO is not about Russian destruction. It's not. So your question launches from a ridiculous Putin talking point that makes me question either your understanding of NATO or the sincerity. That seems like a troll to me. The reality is Mexico is never gonna align with China and Russia. Sorry, not seeing it. But if they did, would they have the right to some kind of, if we were that kind of a threat, and they really wanted to, and they really needed to feel that sense of security? I personally not against it, because maybe we don't have a war. Because at my core, I'm anti-war. But I'm also realistic that sometimes you got to put up a fight. You know, you walk away when you can. I'm not a stand your ground person. I'm a retreat person. If you corner me, you got problems. But this idea that we're going to attack Mexico and they're going to feel threatened, it seems kind of silly on its premise. And the thing that bothers me, and you want to talk about reality checks, the reality check is that Putin invaded Ukraine. And you go, well, why? Well, a bunch of reasons. You know, Putin will tell you he wants to restore the former glory of Mother Russia. Ask him. He will tell you. He'll tell you all about Russian history and the rightful ownership of Ukraine and all the surrounding areas. He'll go back hundreds of years. He can rationalize it. Another reason is he can. Who's going to stop him? We've proven that we're not going to. Ukraine gave up its nukes years ago because we told them, again, broken promises, we told them that we'd ensure their safety. And we're not. And it seems like a lot of the responses I've been getting, and from the Trump administration, they're siding with Putin. Another reason is, you know, it could have been just Tuesday and Putin was bored. But whatever the reason, Putin's the a-hole here. It's not NATO. NATO is incredibly successful at keeping peace in Europe. And we, as America, as the world's leader, we have been at the front of that, ensuring freedom, ensuring safety and security. And the fact that we've kept our allies together and ensured that is, and that we want to go back, is what's really frightening. And that we're siding, there are some who are siding with a guy who wants to reimagine the former Soviet Union. And that there are people who want to destroy those alliances and isolate us. It's crazy. But the sad reality is you got Trump, Vance, Musk, the rest of the Klan, they've made it quite clear. They're not on America's side. Now, I'm not going to be one of those, oh, they're wholly on Russia's side. I think they're on their own side. I think they're on the, hey, how can we cash in? And maybe they see Putin as a way to cash in. I want to hear your thoughts. Keep them coming. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Crazy ones to the top. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Sarah Burris is going to be here to share some thoughts. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I know it's hard to believe, but there are other things going on other than the Friday debacle. And I know it's hard to get past it. I know there are things. And look, this is that kind of Trump-like situation where all the oxygen is out of the room. And we're not paying attention to everything else. But for a moment, we're going to take a look back because, hey, we find out that they want to cut half of the people who work for the Social Security Administration. That means, folks, if you're not happy with the service you're getting from Social Security now, oh, you wait. And here to share some thoughts on, well, the cuts. Dogeboy's out of the news for a moment. But we'll find out what's going on there as well. I've asked my good friend Sarah Burris to come share some thoughts. Sarah is a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how the heck are you?
So upwards of half of the people who work at Social Security, gone, I guess.
Yeah, I feel bad because my mother is actually signing up this year. And I was like, girl, you better start like months ahead of time. Because it's gonna take a while to get somebody on the phone.
But AI, you don't need people. We're past people. AI is gonna do it all, and it'll be Elon Musk's AI. It's gonna be great. Don't worry, Elon's on the job.
You know the best thing about Elon Musk's AI is how much Elon Musk's AI hates Elon Musk. That is the best thing about it, and that's how you know it's like, you know. It is, I think, reach consciousness level, right? Where it's just like, oh, the maker's got to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Interesting, but you know, I thought it was. Did you see Saturday Night Live and the opening?
Yes. So whenever we were talking about, chatting about Zelensky, if anybody hasn't seen Saturday Night Live, that is probably one of the best SNL openers I've seen in a while. I mean, that was just brilliant. And it was perfect because, you know, everybody who was talking on Friday was about, they kind of reached the point throughout the evening where they agreed that it probably was an ambush, that this was all pre-planned, and that this was, you know, just some excuse for Trump to be able to try and get Republicans on Capitol Hill to, you know, to pull away from supporting Ukraine. And it's exactly what happened. But, you know, the absurdity of J.D. Vance, who is just the princess of the White House.
Now, you're not gender shaming, are you?
He wears guyliner.
Guyliner? What the heck is guyliner?
Guyliner instead of eyeliner on guys. Guyliner.
There's no such thing.
Yeah. So, and the Elon Musk, Mike Myers. Oh, you gotta love Mike Myers, right? And the fact, and he was just doing all of the like jumpy up and downs and like
glitch,
you know, holding his. It was so good. It was so good. Best SNL in a long time.
It's just one of those things. But but again, you know, I was waiting for that these last couple of days, for Musk to come out and but then I started thinking about it. You know, with all the cuts that are really not popular, maybe this show with Zelensky was to get away from the show that was Musk, because look, Trump needs that kind of chaos to keep us from really paying attention to just how bad they're governing. And look, I brought up the Social Security thing, but I, you know, also we find out that, you know, they're making cuts to the National Weather Service and to the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, you know, NOAA. And you go, I think that's bad, especially when you got meteorologists saying this could cost people their lives.
Yeah, that's the big thing, is that some of the smartest meteorologists in the country are really going to bat for the folks at NOAA. And I think a lot of people, I mean, folks will see, you know, like 13,000 people that work for this agency. The thing about the National Weather Service that I feel like people forget is that it's a 24/7 agency. They have to staff it 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, so that if anything is happening anywhere, then, you know, it's being caught by one expert or the other. The other major part of it is that there are multiple different locations for the National Weather Service for the purpose of, if, you know, the hurricane experts are over here, the tornado experts are over here, and if the hurricane experts get taken out here, then there's you know, the extra guys who can step in from New Jersey or whatever. So it is so amateurish, I feel like, to look at these agencies that actually are saving lives. And I actually went back on Project 2025 and looked at all of the cuts that they talked about, particularly there's like four pages on NOAA and the National Weather Service. And my favorite part of it is, like, you know, there's this corporate world out there and all of these weather apps. Why do we need the National Weather Service when we have all these apps? And I'm like, you idiot.
It all runs off.
Where does that data come from? I mean, you don't have, you know, all of these people who are just like guesstimating and coloring in a map. Like,
but here, hold
comes
on.
From somewhere.
Yeah, but hold on. You know, you talk to the average person out there. I was looking for my red hat a moment ago, because you talk to the average red hat. Oh, they don't know anything. They're just throwing darts at a dartboard. So if your belief is they don't know anything and they get the weather wrong all the time, what's the point of having it? If they're wrong more often than they're not, and they can't predict anything, if that's what you truly believe, you're going to go along with cutting this down to nothing, because you don't believe in the expertise. You don't believe in what they do. So, yeah, so what if there's a hurricane coming? We'll be surprised.
We'll just be surprised. That's the interesting thing about, you know, when I moved to DC,
or we'll go back to the gods are angry with us.
Right. Geez. When I moved to the East Coast, I was really surprised, because everybody just like crapped all over weather people. And I come from an area of the country where those people are gods. Like the main weather guy for the CBS affiliate in Oklahoma City was the highest paid newsman in the entire country, not just local, the entire country, because he was such a huge tornado expert, and he created all of these incredible monitoring systems. And so I grew up with these brilliant, amazing people who study this stuff and who can basically pinpoint where a tornado is down to the block. Like you can look at, you can zoom in on Oklahoma weather maps, and I can tell, you know, which block is getting hailed on and which block isn't. And that doesn't happen in the Northeast. It blew my mind, where it's like, it really is like just people being like, it could rain.
Yeah. Whereas in Oklahoma, they just go to Bob's house. His house will be fine. George, you're screwed.
Yeah. And the thing that's so crazy to me is, I think that they're putting the smartest people, the best people in the areas of the country where there is weather, right? Like the tornado experts in Florida and the tornado experts in Oklahoma and the Florida guys have the hurricane center. Of course you're going to have the B team, right, out of Jersey, because what kind of weather are you going to need to be monitored in Jersey? Like, it's going to rain.
Jersey.
I know.
But here's the thing. You're talking about red states. Oklahoma, very red state. They do away with this. As you've said, these people are revered. They're gone. They've cut their funding. They're out the door. Does that change any thoughts? Does it change any votes? Does it matter?
You know, I thought, because I've been seeing Department of Ag and USDA cuts that happened, I think, a week or two ago. And I've started to hear people talk about that back home. I am curious to see what will happen with the National Weather Service folks in Oklahoma. And I really would hope that the local weather guys, because now that, you know, the big guy has retired, they have like maybe two or three people who are just, you know, amazing, good personality, and very, very smart and capable. So I would hope that those people would step up and, you know, when they give the 5-day forecast, be like, and by the way, we're thinking about all of our friends who just got screwed at the National Weather Service.
So what do you say to the argument, though, that we'll just privatize that? We don't need, the government shouldn't be funding this. There should be a private entrance. In fact, all those apps, there's an excellent opportunity for them to hire those people and then charge people who want to know if their house is going to get taken out by a tornado.
All of those apps are then going to have to be able to make enough money to launch their own satellites, to be putting their own Doppler radar all over the country. I mean, the thing about the National Weather Service is, because there are so many different offices, it really enables us to get up-to-date information from a lot of different locations and connect it all together. So if these private entities don't have that kind of money, it's been, you know, a 60-year investment from the U.S. government doing this all over the country. And it's as much an infrastructure as, you know, the power grid is.
Yeah.
And it just really, that is one of the big cuts where it just, I mean, all of them kind of seem really stupid, but I mean, that one's, the weather dudes are right. It's going to kill people. People are going to basically, it's going to get pulled out of rural America. Like, that's the thing, is sometimes you have like one or two people at the county level. Those people are going to get cut. So it's like, you're only going to have people out of Oklahoma City versus, you know,
the pain will trickle down. And this, for me, is where the organizing opportunity will come. There's an opportunity to get into these rural communities and talk about, hey, this is what we used to do. They took it from you. There's a way forward. I want to move along. You know, those people will be dead anyway, so they're not going to be all that. I know that's so horrible. But sadly, I mean, this is the world we seem to be in. But I got to get to the really important stuff. Thursday, supposedly, the eagerly awaited Epstein list is supposed to, the file is supposed to be released, and we're going to get to find who we're going to cancel and who the pedophiles and all of those are. And I liked, you know, the SNL skit, that it will go from A to S, no T.
No T.
But will we see finally, and will the T be on the list?
You know, I was kind of reading up on some of the folks who have followed this for years, and a lot of them have said that this black book doesn't really exist. That there is no, you know, list of every person who did every action and you know, raped this person or this person. That kind of thing doesn't exist. What does exist are like communications that he had with people or folks that were on the plane.
There's a travel,
you know, that kind of stuff. So if you have people who, you know, didn't fly to the island but were hanging out at his house, you know, I don't know that those people are going to get outed. I think some folks who've said, who are, you know, talking about the libs being owned by this or something like that, I really don't care. I think if you're a smarmy, disgusting perv, then I don't care what side of the aisle you're on.
Look, you went to that island knowing what that island was. I don't care who you are. You knew what you were going there for. Like, I love Alan Dershowitz.
I kept my underwear on.
It was an old Russian woman. You know what do you mean? Like 12? No, it's not fair. But you know, because I don't know, I wasn't there. But that there were no. I don't believe there were any old Russian women on that island.
I don't think so either. And the idea that any people were acting, you know, in any kind of respectable way, I just don't buy it.
Nope.
I really don't buy it.
No, you were there for one reason and one reason only. And if you were on that island, you're guilty. If you let yourself be in that situation and you didn't do anything, you're still guilty by association. My mother always told me, I'm sure your mother told you too, you're judged by the company you keep. There are videos out there of Donald Trump yucking it up with Epstein, arm in arm, smiling, pointing. There are stories out there of young girls accusing Trump of rape. There's a lot of stuff out there. We just choose selectively to believe one or the other based on what letters behind their name.
And we shouldn't. If you're a smarmy perv, then I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, you're still a smarmy perv and you should be canceled.
So does it come out Thursday? Or is it selective?
I don't know. I think it'll be selective. Yeah, I really do. I think that they'll all of a sudden, like, no Republicans will be on the list.
There'll be some redacted names on there, I'm sure.
I bet they won't even, like, do that. They'll just, like, you know.
Retype it.
Pretend like it doesn't exist. Yeah.
Finally, Kash Patel, head of the FBI, which, you know, frightening on a whole certain level.
Yes.
In fact, I'm almost to the point where I don't even want to say the name to get on his radar, because I fear he's going to be worse than J. Edgar Hoover in a lot of ways. And in fact, you know, you bring on what's that guy's Bingo Bango Bong Bongo, the talk guy,
Bangino,
yeah, him. You bring him on. No serious person should be looking at the FBI right now and going, they've got our interest at heart.
Yeah. The funny thing to me about Kash Patel is that some of his first actions of the week were that he had to coordinate his personal trainer and make sure that his personal trainer had clearance so that he could get in to the FBI building and be able to, you know, have their personal training sessions.
Okay. Not take home classified information or anything.
Well, I mean, I guess if he wasn't doing anything else, I don't know where you put your classified information. But
evidently we're returning it back to Trump.
Yeah. Right. Like, that's the other thing that happened is they turned over all of the stuff from Florida. All the souvenirs back to Donald Trump. But yeah, Kash Patel is, he's working with his personal trainer. he's redecorating the office. Although one of the things that he said early on was that he didn't want to work out of the DC office. He wanted to work out of the Las Vegas office. And so I don't really understand what that's about. You know, he was talking about closing down the FBI building and on day one and turning it into Museum of the Deep State. And distributing all of these other FBI agents to state offices. So, wants to live in Vegas and run the FBI from there.
Hookers and blow.
You know?
There you go. Well, it could get worse, and it's going to. And I'm sure you'll be there to share all the thoughts and the stories with us. Sarah, as always, appreciate the time.
Thank you. Everybody have a good rest of the week.
Our good friend Sarah Burris. Make sure you check out her work, Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Rain to snow late tonight. Winter storm warning for accumulations of 2 to 6 inches and strong wind gusts higher than 40 miles an hour, producing widespread blowing snow. Snow continues through tomorrow afternoon, staying windy. Temps fall from the 30s to 20s. Currently, it's 37.
The Todd Alba Show.
Think about how many people in our communities, our friends, our families, our neighbors, our postal workers, carriers, people that work at our Veterans Affairs hospitals, USDA. Here's what Marjorie Taylor Greene, Donald Trump's lieutenant, thinks of all the people I just mentioned.
Federal employees do not deserve their jobs.
That's what Donald Trump and MAGA believe if you are a federal worker.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So when tragedy or chaos hits, we generally turn to social workers to help ease some of the struggle, get through tough times, navigate the troubled waters, if you will. And in this moment, you could look at the news and go, we've hit some rough terrain, folks. But sadly, the people who have been there to help us in these moments, they themselves are under attack as Donald Trump and Elon Musk are gutting federal employment, going after the federal workforce. Social workers are under attack. I'm here to share some thoughts on what that means for, obviously, the social workers, but what does it mean for the country? I've asked Dr. Anthony Estreet to come talk with us. Dr. Estreet is the CEO of the National Association of Social Workers, the world's largest association of social workers. Anthony, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on your show, Rick. I really appreciate it.
So, you know, as I said, look, you know, there's attacks coming everywhere in the federal workforce. Doge Boy and his little ferrets are in every agency going after every bit of employment. And generally the people that when crisis hits, we lean on for a little support. You guys are under attack now as well.
Yeah, you know, I think that as we're seeing shifts in the federal government and the executive orders come out, there are a lot of social workers that are also under attack, you know, whether it's at the VA. The VA is one of the largest employers of social workers. But also when we think about the freezing of federal funds to nonprofits, there's a lot of social workers that work in nonprofits. And so what we're seeing is a lot of social workers that are anxious. They're concerned about losing their jobs. Some of them have lost their jobs. But not only that, we are experiencing a higher increase of people in the community, individuals that are feeling this pain. So it's creating a much heavier workload for social workers to address mental health, to address substance use, to address anxiety, unhoused. I think the problems that we're seeing are certainly going to kick up more and more as we see these executive orders continue to come out. And then with the upcoming budget, we're seeing or anticipating huge slashes to Medicaid and Medicare. And that's going to really cripple the work that we do, because a lot of our clients that we work with are using Medicaid, using Medicare. They're veterans. They are our parents. They are individuals that we care and know. And so when we talk about uprooting the social safety net, we're really talking about social workers having to do more work, try to find resources, try to scrape for every penny that we can to make sure that people are able to be as well as they possibly can in our society today.
Yeah, you know, I've seen over the years some mocking of social workers, and if you've never needed one, I guess that's easy to do and not understand what they do. But if you do hit a rough patch, if your life does hit a major bump in the road, as we have in our household recently, you understand the importance of a social worker who, one, cares, but two, understands how to get you what you need and actually what you might need. So for me, the idea of gutting social workers at a time of tragedy is unthinkable, because these are the folks who are going to help you navigate the what you need, what you should need, what you should be getting, those things. So it seems duly cruel of an administration to go after not just, you know, the people who process Social Security claims or the people who help our veterans, but the people who are going to help them who help those folks. That to me seems doubly cruel.
No, it is. And one thing that, you know, I have the pleasure of always saying is that social workers are everywhere. And so, you know, if you haven't met a social worker yet, you will in your lifetime, whether it is at the beginning of birth or as you get closer to death, you're going to meet a social worker at some point in time. And my hope is that when you encounter that social worker is caring, that social worker is empathetic, and that social worker does want to see the best for you. At the same time, really understanding that this administration is really telling social workers that, hey, we're not really concerned about the work that you do because we're gutting Medicaid and Medicare. We are reducing research spending for social work programs. We are attacking diversity, equity, inclusion, which is built into the very fabric of social work education in the work that we do. Our whole purpose is to really think about how can we make people feel much more of a belonging in their environment. And that could be diversity, that could be equity, and that could be inclusive, right? And so when people have framed this argument around diversity, equity, inclusion being about race, they've totally missed the idea about what DEI is, right? And so when we talk about accessibility, it's really making sure and advocating for policies and programs that ensure that people that are in wheelchairs can enter buildings, because we have buttons that open doors for us. We have ramps that get up different grades. And so, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion is more than just race. It looks at gender, it looks at abilities, it looks at language, it looks at neuroprocessing, looks at a lot of different things, but we've relegated it to race to make it seem like this idea around diversity, equity, inclusion is all about race, when it's really about how do we increase access and belonging to everybody.
You know, it's interesting you went to that place, because, you know, I've always said I believe life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Everyone pursue your happiness, your belief, and that we're all equal. And that, to me, was the right messaging. I don't think we got a lot of good messaging around this. And I think the right was able to pick this up and appeal to the worst of us in a way that just made it. It's just about race. It's just about someone getting something that you're not, instead of saying, no, this is about everyone having an equal opportunity. It's about our founding ideals and principles, instead of just what they were spoon fed.
Well, I think it's interesting, right? You know, the shift is to this idea of meritocracy, and we've seen, you know, meritocracy on display time and time again. We've seen people being admitted to Harvard University because their dad went to Harvard University or whatever, and so this idea of meritocracy as a contrast to diversity, equity, inclusion is just the wrong association. Nobody is saying that diversity, equity, inclusion means that people get a leg up. It means that people get a fair shake. And if you have the credentials, skills, and abilities to receive that job, then you should get a fair shake at that job, not be somehow discredited because of race, gender, or because of your ability. I think that it really does talk about and highlight how do we make it an equal playing field for everybody.
And I think it was Yale, if I remember right. You know, George W. Bush went to Yale because Daddy and Grandpa went to Yale. Couldn't get into the University of Texas, but somehow got into Yale through the legacy. And this is it's an excellent point, in that we were sold this for the working class, this idea of capitalism and meritocracy. If you work hard, you play by the rules, maybe possibly there'll be a crumb for you, not getting ahead. But for our upper crust, it's a lot of socialism. And they've got the best social workers and the best social programs. And well, and right now, the best government money can buy.
Well, you know, and I think, you know, I want to go back to this, right? Because when we talk about meritocracy, when we talk about people that do great work, it brings me back to just the whole idea of social work in our profession. You know, we do a lot of great work and we ensure that the safety net of America is kept into place, right? At the same time, I would be remiss if I did not talk about how low we are being paid to do this work. And so the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that a fully licensed social worker functioning at the top of their class should only be making about $57,000 or $58,000 a year. And if you've ever met a social worker and you see the work that we do, you know that the work that we do is essential to our everyday functioning and should be valued and compensated at much higher. And so I would not be doing us justice during Social Work Month. So happy Social Work Month to all the social workers out there. If I did not talk about the contrast between those that are in the highest echelons of government making rules about, you know, how we interact in the world, but while also making those that help to build our society paying us the lowest amounts. And so for me, it's about this social work profession. Our social work profession is a very noble profession, and we have our origins in child welfare. But at the same time, we are also very much in tech space and financial spaces doing some amazing work. And without us, and again, I say this time and time again, social workers are truly everywhere. We are in every sector, every aspect of everyday things that people do. And so when you think about artificial intelligence, we are in those companies helping people to ensure that artificial intelligence is not racially biasing people, that they're not putting in bad code. So we're trying to make sure that we are keeping the human aspect into the things that we do. And so this social work, this year's Social Work Month theme is compassion plus action. It's really telling everybody that it's great that we have compassion. Everybody should have that compassion. But in the current climate, and as we move forward, people have to take action. People have to get out of their couch. They have to go vote. They have to engage in this process, and they have to advocate for the change that they want to see. And so compassion plus action is really the theme that we're trying to highlight and elevate. And that is where social workers live. We take this compassion, this care that we have for the people that we serve, and then we turn it into some type of action to ensure that people can live their whole lives.
So to take all of that and to kind of, you know, to bring it into where you started off with being the lowest paid. Is that not part of the problem? I mean, the whole compassion, the whole, the nurturing economy, the caring economy, which, I'm trying not to be sexist, but isn't that viewed as women's work now? And don't we pay women less in the caring economy?
You went to that place, and I think that's fine. I think that the reality of the situation is for far too long.
Is it wrong? Let me ask you, am I wrong?
No, I think that on the onset, social work in and of itself is a profession that has a majority women social workers, right? And so in that, I think that, yes, it is a profession that is a helping profession, one that is predominantly entered in by women. At that same time, I think that this does bring into the larger conversation around pay equity and what that looks like across the board. And so when we think about the work, it is really thinking about, yes, there are men and women in social work, but they're also across different sectors. So from child welfare all the way to banking, finance, and technology, across those sectors, you know, there's going to be men, trans women, however you identify. It's really going to be people in those sectors doing a lot of good work. And I think that from that, it's really bad statistics, right? And so, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they pretty much say, hey, if you have this title of social workers, you can take this survey and we'll see how much it comes up to. What we're advocating for is that when they're collecting that data is that they actually use what we define as a social worker. And that is somebody that has graduated from a CSWE, Council for Education, accredited program with a degree in social work that can actually call themselves a social worker. And so that would help to elevate that, because in some spaces I've seen, and this is across the country, you know, different states allow people to say that they're social workers, different jobs allow people to call themselves social worker. And that to me is where, you know, title protection comes into this argument around how do we then help to bolster the profession and ensure that pay equity is a thing.
I see it. You know, I'm with you. I'm on your side here, but I just sadly see that social work, you know, tends to be dismissed because it is in the caring economy, and we don't, as a country, I don't think we care.
You know, I think that's the unfortunate reality. And I think that part of my job and the job of NASW is to make the country care. It is to advocate on behalf of the profession. It is to show the why it is important to pay social workers what they're owed. And so that is the goal.
Not what they owe, what they earn. Because one of the things that drives me crazy, people, I get what I deserve. No, you get what you earn. Because you guys do valuable work. But here's the last line of questioning I've got for you. Because, you know, is this another scenario where we're not going to realize how valuable social workers are until they're gone? You know, I've been saying throughout this whole thing with Trump and Musk, there's going to be a lot of pain. There's going to be a lot of suffering. Bad things are going to happen to good people. We can't stop it. But it's going to be the organizing that comes out of that suffering that's going to bring us the solutions that we need to move forward. Is social work one of those things where we finally wake up and go, oh, this is why it was so important? And then we strengthen it on the other side only after these attacks? Or do you see a different way forward?
No, I think you're absolutely correct. I think that, you know, one of the things that we've seen, and this was, you know, going through the pandemic and coming after the pandemic, was this increase in mental health. You know, social work is one of the largest professions that provide the most amount of behavioral health care in the United States. And so even at that, we are still experiencing a mental health shortage. And so when you see these increases in mental health, it's because our workforce is continuing to play catch up. But at the same time, because of the low pay, because of the high caseloads, we're seeing people that are burning out and that are leaving the profession for other jobs. And so this country will feel the impact of social work loss. At the same time, we're advocating on the front end to advocate for higher policies around reimbursements for Medicaid. So making sure that we are pushing the Improving Access to Mental Health Care Act, which has an increase for social workers in reimbursements for Medicaid. Really talking to and advocating for private insurance companies to quit with all of the barriers when it comes to reimbursements. Because what we're also seeing is that social workers are leaving that private insurance space because of so many barriers. And so really thinking through and attacking this from both the policy aspect, but also the advocacy in corporate America.
Yeah, it's sadly, we're gonna walk a rough road here over the next couple of years. And the hope is that we come to our senses at some point and turn around and realize what's important. And I think social workers are important. I think the work that you do is important. But sadly, it's one of those things. Every generation, I guess, has to relearn the lessons from the past. But Dr. Estreet, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts with us. Keep up the great work. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this sad period continues.
Thank you so much, Rick. I appreciate it sharing our story. And I hope that everybody is able to engage in a little bit of compassion and a lot of action.
Good stuff. Dr. Estreet, I appreciate you taking time for us. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Have you had to deal with social workers? Have you had good experience, bad experience? Is it something we should allow them to continue to attack? And what does it look like when we don't have any? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1914. That was the day that President Woodrow Wilson signed the Seamen's Act into law. The act was in part a response to the tragic sinking of the Titanic. The International Seamen's Union was demanding changes to the working conditions at sea. The job of a seaman required long times away from home and tough physical labor. The workers had few rights. The union found a friend in Senator Robert La Follette of Wisconsin. He championed a new law that set guidelines for basic safety and decent working conditions for those who sailed under the American flag. The act set the work week at a maximum of 56 hours. It established holidays for non-essential crew. The law also improved working conditions by setting standards for cleanliness and safety on board. It abolished the practice of jailing seamen that tried to desert the ship. it required that seamen be paid half of their wages during the voyage. The practice had been to withhold wages to ensure the workers did not desert the ships at port. The new law also required that 16 square feet of space be given to each worker for sleeping. It also mandated that ships should have adequate lifeboats. These last two provisions angered the ship owners because it meant there would be less space on board for cargo. Finally, the law gave seamen the right to organize into unions. Senator La Follette described the negative reaction of the owners to his law by observing, "Already, the masters of the seas are beginning to threaten dire vengeance." The act was a major victory for the rights of labor on the high seas. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Started today's program off with an email. Going to finish up with an email. And I got a couple of these, but the one that caught my attention was Janice asked what my thoughts were on Trump's gold card. And if this was an NFT, if this was another scheme to enrich Donald Trump, if this was another way for the Trump kids to cash in on the presidency. And let me start off by saying, not 100% sure. Don't know an awful lot about the gold card that Trump is selling. But in concept, I don't know that I'm entirely against the idea of having a high-level path to citizenship for people who come here to do high-paid jobs. And where I think this goes awry, this is just a strict, if you're rich, you can buy citizenship. Not so thrilled with that. Understand how it could be beneficial to we the taxpayers if we pay off the debt, if we better yet use it to fund social programs, if we end homelessness, if we end childhood poverty, if we use the resources in a better way, I'm all in favor of fleecing the wealthy a little bit. We're not going to tax them, so this seems like not a bad idea. But I think the better way to go, because what this would do is, as I understand, it's going to replace the current EB-5 visa, which is, rich people who are going to come and say that they're going to spend money and invest in areas. So you're basically buying your way. And look, a lot of countries have this kind of buy your way to citizenship path as well. I would see it a little differently. What I would like to see is this sold to corporate America. The only way you get this is through corporate America, because they're not paying taxes. This would be kind of a tax, if you will, on them bringing in other labor, especially Silicon Valley. I know. You corporate America, you bash them. Yeah, right. This is a way to tax them, I think. They're bringing in people already to do jobs that Americans should be doing. And I know this is, you're xenophobic. No. Look at what's gone on. They've abused the systems, the HB1 visa especially. The whole system is broken. And if you go, okay, fine, we're going to be honest and open about it. We're just going to open it up to the highest bidder. And we're going to make corporate America pay for what they're already doing. Then I maybe don't have as much of a problem. And as I said, look, more than 100 other countries have these gold kind of visas that allow rich people to come and go. They live in different worlds. In fact, like I said, we've got it as well here. So this idea that for the upper crust, the folks who have $5 million and they want American citizenship, I'm not against it. Now, here's the thing. Trump said if we get a million people, it's going to be, $5 trillion. Are there a million people going to come to want to be U.S. citizens and buy their way in for $5 million? I don't know. Are there 10 million, like he said, which would give us $50 trillion? We could pay off all the debt. I don't know. I don't think so. But there's part of me that goes, you know, if corporate America wants to buy them up and bring in, you know, foreign labor, they can do that. In fact, you know, there's been part of me that's been thinking, you know, our path towards immigration, since it is corporate America who benefits from our immigration, our broken immigration system. Understand, it's these poor folks who are coming from other places looking for a better life. They're desperate, pliable, and oh boy, a corporate CEO's dream. Desperate labor, easily exploitable, under the radar, willing to do anything for anything. Yeah, I say we start selling the visas through there. You want to be a low wage employer, and you're gonna pay the bottom rung. You know, at least pay the taxpayer. There's a part of me that goes, be honest about the situation we're in. Now I know my immigration friends are gonna lose their minds. I understand that people are going to be upset, but at a certain point you go, they're doing it anyway. The system is broken. And I know I can already hear somebody, like, I can't believe you're siding with Donald Trump. On this, we already do it badly. If there's a way to maybe do it a little bit less badly, I don't know. Look, I look at our HB1 visa system that allows foreign workers to come into this country if they have a specialty occupation. If there aren't Americans who can do those jobs. You know, there shouldn't be anyone out there who has the kind of skills that Americans can't get and don't have. So for me, just the premise of it right from the beginning, just right from the start, is one of those things that it seems broken. So this is just being honest. Going, look, okay, you want to bring somebody in from India to do computer work? Okay, you're going to pay for that, right? I don't necessarily have a problem with that. Now, I know it's going to be indentured servitude and all this, maybe a little bit, but put some rules in place to maybe alleviate some of that. There's a way forward. Do I think it's going to happen? I don't know. Maybe. But I'm interested to see how many people would actually want it, considering that if you're in that upper crust, if you got $5 million that you can say, I'd like to be an American citizen. If you have $5 million, are you going to care about citizenship? Because you can come and go as you please anyway. It's not like if you've got $5 million to give away to become for citizenship, you probably don't need a job here. So I don't know. I am curious what everyone else thinks. This is one of those things where my gut reaction is not to throw it out of hand. I see the value in it. If rich people want to come here, you know, okay, let's tax them a little bit. Because we don't tax rich people enough at all. Maybe this is a start. And I would really love to see corporate America get hit with this. And it seems to me to be a way to one, raise some revenue to get to the things that we need, you know, better infrastructure, investments in education, healthcare, you know, all those things that we talk about wanting. There seems to be a way, you know, potentially forward. And this could be a way where, you know, maybe Trump would be right. You know, Mexico would pay for it, or, you know, someone from Argentina or who knows where. I do want to hear your thoughts, though. Do you see pitfalls? Do you see the benefits of this? And just because it's Trump doesn't mean you throw it out of hand, because I try not to do this. But I do see the possibility because everything that Trump does, and I think I've got that kind of thought process, everything that Trump does, I am looking for the angle. I'm looking for where he's going to be lining his pockets and loading up you know, his profit margin. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, email me at rick@therickssmithshow.com. Check out the podcast. If you ever had one of those days, today has been my day. Thanks so much for being here. As always, great having you. Look forward to next time. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper at a joint session of Congress right now.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
President Trump tells a joint session of Congress that the U.S. will be woke no longer as he touts cutting diversity, equity and inclusion programs and bans transgender people from the military. He also takes credit for swift and unrelenting action in reorienting the nation's economy, immigration and foreign policy. And there was an early sign of dissent.
Small business optimism saw its single largest one-month gain ever recorded, a 41-point jump.
Members are directed to uphold and maintain decorum in the House and to cease any further disruptions.
Democratic Congressman Al Green of Texas was removed from the House chamber after yelling and refusing to sit down. President Trump also takes aim at Democrats, some holding signs.